The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, what an exciting day in the BS Report. One of my bosses is on, actually the guy who brought me to ESPN and a mentor of mine at ESPN. We have a love-hate relationship that I would say is 98% love. John A. Walsh, longtime ESPN executive, and really the guy who made SportsCenter what it is and has done a variety of things for the company. It's an honor to have you on.
It's an honor to be here, and I have no hate in my body.
Yeah, I know you don't. It's a love.
Lots of love.
What would be a better word than hate? I don't even know.
Creative disagreements occasionally that amount to 2% of your copy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you always find that one thing where you email me, like, I love the column, it was great, except for that one paragraph, why'd you do that?
Except the last column, I loved everything. The last column, I didn't say anything like that. It was effusive praise.
Mm. Well, see, they probably took out the one thing, the one joke that
you wouldn't have liked. Email.
Yeah, it was by email. It's always by email if it's effusive. All right, let's talk about newspapers, because we can talk about the ESPN stuff later, but you heard the podcast that I did with Chuck Klosterman.
Yes,
you
were
a longtime media guy.
Going way back.
You've been in every sort of media type of situation, and the newspaper thing is very personal for you.
Yes, I spent 10 years of my alleged adult life in newspapers at the Columbia Missourian, Newsday, and the Washington Post.
And you thought that we missed some topics, which I agreed with, because as I told you, it was, you know, we were ad-libbing that. I never really thought we would even talk about that, or if we did, it would be a couple minutes, and it turned into 45. And we talked about some of the factors that put newspapers in the position that we're in. I think the three we mentioned were unions, the immediacy of the internet, and the ad sales, how everything's moved to Craigslist and stuff like that. But as you mentioned when we talked about it, there's 6-7 more factors that we should talk about.
Those are minor concerns to me. They're small things. And, you know, newspapers have had a great lifetime. What other business has had a 360-year run?
Right.
That's phenomenal. But I think that the newspapers in the 20th century, the demise of the modern newspaper started in the mid-50s. And if you take one fact that in 1960 to 2009, the American population increased by 63%. During that same period of time, American newspapers' circulation decreased by 3.7 million.
Wow.
And it happened for a reason. Once the baby boomers came into some sort of maturity, Some would say in those early years a great deal of immaturity, and established the counterculture revolution, the powers that be and the status quo in newspapers decided that it wasn't anything to cover only very much, but just occasionally. So basically, it began the biggest swings and misses in the history of modern media. They swung and missed the counterculture revolution. They swung and missed rock and roll. They swung and missed sports on cable. When USA, TBS, HBO, and ESPN came into existence, the sports pages in daily newspapers did not change. They swung and missed talk radio. They swung and missed the coverage of technology and computers. They swung and missed the age of wealth on Wall Street. They swung and missed covering the internet. And now they're determined to not swing and miss when it's their own death. They're burying themselves very comfortably.
Wow. That was extensive. I agree.
Well, I believe this. The population went up, and people running newspapers decided we know what people want. They didn't monitored the behavior of people, and all of a sudden people stopped reading. I have two children in ages 26 and 23, and in my house, I can't remember when they picked up a newspaper. When I thought there was a story they'd like, I handed it to them and said, here, you might want to read this.
Yeah, I think, as you said, the arrogance of the newspapers is that we're fine. We don't need to do that. And, you know, I remember when I was working at the Herald, I pitched them a weekly fantasy sports column. And this is like 1994, 1995. It's like, hey, this fantasy sports, it's really coming on. And they wouldn't even consider it. It's like, really? Fantasy sports? Get out of here. It was like, that was the attitude. And that's, you know, that speaks to your point of things were happening culturally. The newspapers weren't picking it up.
They thought if they cover, they think the mindset is if we cover it once, we've covered it. It's not really worthy of a beat. What's really important in the newspapers is the ROI. And that ROI, return on investment, has to be 30%, 35%. And it starts to shrink. Oh, we got to cut staff. The way the papers were run, they didn't understand. It killed me. I had an opportunity to go back into the newspapers when I decided that I was going to try another professional. I was out of work in 1983. And had a couple of offers from newspapers and said, you know what? I've done that for 10 years. I don't see it going anywhere. I've got to try something different. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that they were just stuck. They didn't know how to make a big move, a bold move. For instance, with the internet, Bill, I look at the internet right now and newspapers, I believe, for the most part, think that the internet is an electronic newspaper. They don't think it's a different being. They don't think that it's newspaper and news is definitely a commodity and a part of the internet, but it's not the whole experience of the internet. How many newspapers in the United States went to Silicon Valley, went to Austin, Texas, went to Seattle, Washington, or any other hub of internet activity and said, you know what? You guys know the internet. I'm hiring the best person out of this culture and I'm going to have them run the newspaper's internet site. Had they done that, we would be looking at a whole different, the newspaper that would do that and would have done that in the late 90s would be so far ahead today.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, because I was there on the internet from 97 to 2001, which was really when everybody was trying to figure everything out. And the people that were landing on the internet in decision making roles were basically people that had failed at newspapers and magazines. There were people that didn't have a lot of other career options, and the internet people obviously didn't know what they were doing. So it was like, yeah, well, let's roll the dice on this guy. He worked here and here. And the people who they were rolling the dice on were saying, yeah, I'm going to roll the dice with this internet thing. And I think that led to a lot of maybe the decisions on the internet that weren't that good. Like you look back and what was really making it in the late 90s from a news site standpoint, not really. Even our website, I don't think, was really good until 2000.
Well, you look at what's going on part of it was just kind of treading water to see what this thing is going to be. Meanwhile, you had all these genius engineers who were inventing this, and they weren't the same as the engineers or the pressmen or the back shop at a newspaper. These were really thinking people who had creative minds who were inventing a new medium.
Yeah.
And they were able to take control of some of it. They felt they had to have news at some point, but some of them existed without news and were just able to have fun with what they were creating on the internet. And that's part of what this medium is. I still don't think, remember, we're in year 12. Let's go back 348 years and see what the newspapers were like in year 12. I would suppose it would be, you know, a similar progress of we don't know what the hell this thing is and we don't know where it's going to go. But you look at where the internet is today, I don't think that we've realized anywhere near the potential of what this medium is, the uniqueness and the eccentricities and the unique qualities of the cursor and what the cursor can do. It's not just interactivity. They can create things that the cursor can make really interesting. The NBA trade machine on our website is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's a unique thing that can't be another medium. Typically, when new mediums are invented, when newspapers go to magazines and magazines hire newspaper people, when radio's invented, they hire newspaper and magazine people. When TV's invented, they hire radio people. And that's just the nature of the way this goes. And, you know, I remember television in the early 50s. It was a lot of radio shows on TV. Jack Benny, Arthur Godfrey, Amos and Andy, whatever it was. They were old radio shows reformat it for TV. Now look at the internet today. We have podcasts, which are audio, which is a form of radio. We have the moving video, which is TV. We have print, which is magazines, newspapers, and books. But we also have this uniqueness, which we have not exploited to the extent that it's going to be exploited in the next 50 years.
And we've already made a lot of progress just in the fact that, like, a Celtics game can end, and in 30 minutes or 45 minutes, whatever it is, I could go on ESPN.com and watch the highlights of that game. It's amazing, and something that I never would have thought would have been possible 5 years ago. But the thing with the newspapers, you know, I think they did have the right idea in the late 90s. They could kind of see where this was going, and a lot of them, they rushed to try to come up with some sort of pay model on the internet for what they were doing. And a reader pointed this out to me. All of the pay model type ideas that everybody had from 99, 2000, 2001, they weren't going to work for a really weird reason, which was that people didn't really feel comfortable putting their credit card information online. I know I didn't. You never knew if somebody could steal it, or you never knew who could see it. And there was a hesitance, which now I think in the last 4 or 5 years, people are fine with putting their credit cards on, but they abandoned that model early, thinking it wasn't going to work, when really the reason it didn't work was because people just weren't ready to put their information online. Now they are.
And that was the reason that Yahoo had the best the largest number of fantasy players, because ESPN was charging for fantasy. And
right.
Everybody went to Yahoo because it was for free, for the very reason you state, that they didn't want to put their income or their credit card at risk.
But if the newspapers had just stuck to their guns at that point and just said, you know what, maybe this, you know, we're going to reach a point where, I guess they would have known, but maybe we're going to reach a point where people are going to be fine with putting their credit card online. Let's just work on this pay model for the next 6-7 years. Instead, they went the other way and said, uh-oh, well, let's give everything away for free and we'll put ads and banners on it. And, you know, I was living in Boston. I read the Globe every day. I used to buy it. Why am I going to buy it when I can read it online?
Well, the worst part of that for the newspaper mindset was exactly what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast here, which is the newspapers then said, you know what, it's not going to be worth anything for us. We're not going to really be able to monetize it. It's chicken, you know, chicken feed here, which we're getting for our ads and our banners. So we don't have to put our best people there. We don't have to break stories there, and we don't have to invent something new. So therefore, they didn't have any amount of resources or any way to say, you know what, this is a whole different medium. I don't understand why people don't do that. It makes me crazy that people don't recognize the unique qualities of a new medium.
Well, they look down on it, which was the other thing. I remember even like late with my website, when I was getting like 15,000 readers, it's still the attitude was, oh, he's online. Oh, he's, you know, like I had no legitimacy whatsoever because I wasn't in a newspaper. And I think that arrogance really came back to bite them a little bit, because as the online thing was taking off, the newspapers realized really late that they needed to get involved. And their idea of getting involved was basically, all right, we're going to have blogs. We're going to have our beat writers posting quick stuff from Fenway. And meanwhile, the way they really could have beaten the internet was by just beating them with better writing and better reporting. Instead, they went the other way and tried to emulate what the internet was doing, which is a huge mistake.
Well, there is a great deal, a part of the American character that is uncomfortable with change, whatever that change may be. In the early 80s, when the cable TV took off and their show started, SportsCenter. I wasn't working at ESPN. Let's get the record clear here. I was not here for the first 8 years of ESPN. And I was watching the SportsCenter every night. It, for me, as a sports fan, it was, I died and went to heaven.
Yeah.
I no longer had 3 minutes. And if there was a snowstorm, it was 2.5 minutes, because weather took up too much time. But when it got to, I got 30 minutes of sports and highlights and all the stuff that I want. And it, you know, SportsCenter just kept getting better and better and better. I came here in 88 and SportsCenter was darn good, but we still continued, I thought, to get better and better. And a couple of sports editors called me and they said, you know what, we got to watch you every night because we got to think about our section the next day. They didn't really think about the section. And even to this day, there is no need for a game story. There is a way to radically look at a sports page and change it completely and make it much more interesting than it has ever been. But you're just stuck with the status quo. And I cannot understand that kind of thinking where you can't be radical and look at something that's right for the age in which you're living and more contemporary for a contemporary audience.
Well, don't you think that the failure of the National, like if you're just talking sports sections, the fact that the National failed so spectacularly kind of made people think, well, maybe we shouldn't take chances.
Well, I think that the National was such a big deal, and yet the National did not understand the mentality of a sports fan, the same way the newspapers don't right now even understand the mentality of the Internet.
Because of the box scores.
You can get the box scores on the Internet now. You could not get all of the box scores. And you talk about fantasy sports taking off around 1988, 89, in the early stages of it. You wanted all the box scores, and you couldn't get them. And there's no way a newspaper is going to succeed. The Wall Street Journal has now started a sports page. There are no box scores. How much readership do you think they're going to get with 2,000-word features every day, a little, you know, predictions of tonight's games? And I look at it because I have to look at it. It's part of my business, and I want to know what the other guys are doing. But there's no box scores.
Well, and I remember when the National came out, they put so much thought into who they were hiring, what they were going to do.
Great staffing.
It was really such an unbelievable paper. I thought it was an extension of what you started at Inside Sports, but
it was a daily version of it. A daily version of it. And you know, we have five or six staffers who when it folded, we scooped up and hired at ESPN. In fact, the person who runs our newsroom, Vince Doria, was one of the top editors at the National.
So they had this awesome idea, and the reason it didn't work was a really dumb reason that you look back and you think, God, how did they not know that? But it was because of the way they printed it, they couldn't get the box scores, the late box scores, or even like the mid-range box scores in the paper.
I couldn't understand it because USA Today figured that out. USA Today figured that out in 1982, and they got it right. And they were America's national sports paper. And I think part of the reason that the National failed is because you were comparing it to USA Today. And the National was superior in so many ways for photography, for layout, for
features,
thoughtfulness, columnists, all those things. But USA Today just, you know, they beat them into the ground because they do enough to have the box scores.
When a lot of people don't know this, the reason that we connected pretty early was my favorite magazine growing up was Inside Sports.
The original Inside Sports.
The original Inside Sports, not the reconstituted
Illinois one in the late 80s.
Not the flashy one. No, the one that actually had real writing and good writers. And I think, what was it, late 1979, 1980?
We did a test issue, and this is an interesting fact. We put out our test issue on September 10th, 1979, 3 days after this crazy idea was happening in Bristol, Connecticut, that they were launching an all-sports network, 24 hours of sports.
Wow.
And that was the worst idea ever. 3 days later, we went to press with Inside Sports.
Wow.
And then 1980, we got the go-ahead in November of 79, and we launched our first issue in April of 1980 with Nolan Ryan on the cover because he had accomplished something no other athlete had accomplished to that time. What was that, Bill?
$1 million a year?
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Look at the man can answer trivia questions. That's why he can host this show.
Yeah, but I also have all the old Inside Sports.
I'm buried in my garage. You're looking at them now. Anyway,
it was for a young writer. You can't ask for a better magazine than Inside Sports because every issue had four or five unbelievable pieces. As I've told you and I've even written about, you had the Pete Axthom gambling column, which had a profound effect on my life.
You know, we did 33 issues. I'm reliving this a little bit now. We just hired about a year ago Bill Knack, a wonderful writer from Sports Illustrated, probably the most literate and best horse racing writer of all time.
Yep.
Anyway, Bill, I had worked with Bill at Newsday in a previous lifetime. Both of us were there. And I was Bill's editor when he wrote a sports column. And boy, I wanted to steal one writer from Sports Illustrated, and Bill was my guy.
Right.
And I worked my tail off recruiting Bill. And finally, just Bill did not have the nerve. He did not want to take a risk. And he said, I got four kids, John. I'm not going to do it. I'm sorry I can't do it. So, well,
talk about the first staff you hired had some amazing names on it.
But no, hold on. I got to finish this up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because this is a good one. So
I thought it was done.
No, we sucked it up and we didn't have Bill Nack. I kept the spot open and I'm on vacation in Philadelphia and I'm reading the papers. I said, man, this guy's a pretty good writer. He's covering high school. He's covering football. I went back and said, give this guy a chance. Give him a chance to write here. He did a couple features for us, and everybody comes in and says, we got to hire him full time. So that slot went to Gary Smith.
Wow.
As our first staff writer, replacing what would have been Bill Nack.
Sounds like a Wally Pipp thing.
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
So you had Gary Smith, you had Kornheiser.
We had Kornheiser, we had Roy Blount Jr., Ira Burkow did some stuff for us.
Diane K. Shaw.
Boy, you're getting. I got to think of what Roger Director. He did some really good stuff for us.
I thought there was a couple more columnists, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were. There was a Mike Ruby from Newsweek was our business writer. We had the Elias Sports Bureau with Steve Hurt, which he had just graduated from Fordham. He did our first creative statistics called By the Numbers page.
Right. Didn't you have Thomas Boswell?
Yes, we had Tom Boswell from the Washington Post. We had Ken Turan from the Washington Post. Well, Inside Sports was published by Newsweek, which was owned by the Washington Post. And I had worked at the Washington Post, and the sports editor was very kind to allow us to use writers from the Washington Post sports section to give them a couple pieces a year. Which was a lot of fun because, you know, Boz would, you know, create new things. We had a wonderful, humor writer, named, Louis Grossberger, who did a, fictional, letters to the editor.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that was,
Didn't it work? I mean, this was my favorite magazine as a kid. I loved it even more than Sports Illustrated, which I loved almost as much as anything. And within 3 years, it was gone.
It was a bad time in the economy.
It was a little like now.
Yeah, it's a little like now. There was a little risk aversion. The Washington Post company's stock price was going down. The people at Time Inc. who were selling Sports Illustrated, they gave a big hurrah because they thought we were like 6 months from cracking it and going over the top. We couldn't. The one business thing that we did not do, and we could not sell on newsstands to the extent that we thought we could. We thought we could do a lot of local covers. Turned out it wasn't cost effective to do that. And when we didn't sell on newsstands, subscriptions are expensive to get. Newsstand is a lot of money drops to the bottom line. So, as a result, you know, we were losing. Oh, I forget. Oh God. We lost, I think, something like, $12 million.
Oh.
And, but we lost that in 3 years. Sports Illustrated lost that in about a dozen years when they launched in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And the Washington Post hired a new CEO, CFO, and he came in and he just said, turn this thing around in 2 months or I'm killing you. And I went in and begged Katherine Graham to sell us and not kill us. And she sold us to an outfit in Seattle and they had enough money for 9 more issues. And we finished up with 33 issues and I spilled all my blood on the floor.
Well, and ironically, my favorite number, 33. Do you think a monthly magazine, that was really the last attempt, I guess, because, you know, sport was kind of going downhill at that point. Now there's no monthly magazine that I could think of other than like Slam, something like that. Why doesn't a monthly magazine work? It just seems like it should work.
I think a monthly magazine could work, but it takes an awful lot of dedication. Actually, what's going to happen now for the weekly magazines, the proposition for weekly and biweekly for both our magazine, ESPN Magazine, and Sports Illustrated is they're going to be taken out of their game, and they are going to have to become what, in effect, are monthly magazines because they're going to have to cover sport in a different way than they've ever covered it before because of what the Internet means.
Well, hasn't ESPN, the magazine, always tried to do that? They always try to look ahead.
We have to go further. We have to go further with it because these things are happening so quickly on the web. There's so much material that's out there, and sports has changed so much. You know, since I've been at ESPN, when I started here, there was one sports talk radio station. We now have 700 alone, 325, which have ESPN as part of their letters.
Yeah.
The Internet, is, you know, the internet was nothing. It was 5,000, 25,000 people in the early mid 90s. And we now have, you know, on a monthly basis, 22 million unique users. And so this stuff is happening at such a rapid pace, let alone what we're doing with all sports, you know, television. We have, you know, four big networks that we're doing, you know, and now we're coming up with ESPNU. There's so much out there that magazines and newspapers, they are going to be forced even further to be more creative.
And the stories are getting digested, consumed, and spat out before a magazine like Sports Illustrated can even get its issue out.
I think you run great risks. You run great risks of doing something that has any sense of a time factor involved in it.
Because, well, for me, it seems like a monthly magazine makes more sense than a weekly magazine to me at this point. Because in a monthly magazine, you could do all big picture stories and creative stuff. And in a weekly, I couldn't do that. I'd rather just read a website.
But you're right. But I see what I'm saying is that you have to take the New Yorker is a monthly magazine masquerading as a weekly.
Right.
Okay. You could take the Vanity Fair conceit of today and say, okay, I don't know that you have the disposition or the thinking or enough people thinking in the way that they're thinking about the way, you know, a Vanity Fair, an Esquire, a GQ, Atlantic Monthly. There's a Bill right now in, forget the sports magazine field, in the magazine field, it's terrific. I mean, there are so many really good magazines. You know, I don't know how much I can read, but I get them all and look at them and I get ideas from them and you try and read a couple articles in them. But these guys, they're thinking in a different way and you can impose that. It's a way of thinking. It's not necessarily the timing of the publishing. And also, if you're really thinking smartly, The current issue of Vanity Fair, I just happened to be reading it last night. They have four articles on the economy and Bernie Madoff and yep. Iceland, and they're all terrific.
The Noel family. I would throw New York Magazine in that mix too.
Absolutely.
Because that's a weekly that I always read two things in there that I love that could have run in a monthly or a weekly.
He's fantastic. He used Adam Moss as the editor. He used to be the editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and he started off doing a weekly magazine. It was a consumer magazine called 7 Days in Manhattan in the early 80s, right when Inside Sports was launching. He was just out of school. He's a really good editor.
Well, where do you see ESPN the magazine heading in all this?
Because
this week we had the cover, half of it was a Gatorade ad, which I was surprised by.
And yours truly was surprised as well. It's, you know, I think that we have to think what I'm thinking. You have to think about a new paradigm for the way sports are covered because you can't do notes columns anymore because they're all gone. You have to figure out, what your opinion pieces are. Like the column that you did this week and let your audience know, I don't normally praise Bill. You know, effusively as I did for this column, many people in Bristol think that I put him up to writing the column. But
yeah.
it's columns like that that are examining things that people aren't aware of that are making them smarter about the way they consume sports, think about sports, and understand the way sports is being thought about and played. That's what we have to be.
I agree. That's what I try to do. I fail most of the time, but sometimes.
Well, you hit
all
runs,
single.
You know, enjoy the trot around the bases for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think I got to second base. That's about it. Yeah, it's interesting, and I don't know where it's going. I also think we have too many people. You know, when I was trying to get a column in the, you know, from basically I graduated from college. I had this column that was very successful in my college, and I just assumed I was going to continue to have a column. And came to find out that it just didn't work that way. We had too few people writing about sports in the 90s. Now I feel like we have, you know, too many. We have too many outlets, too many things to read. And it seems like it's becoming more sensationalistic. And people are just throwing stuff out and trying to prove it, basically.
Well, I think the internet in all regards, with respect to culture, whether it's the entertainment culture, the sports culture, even politics, that there, you know, there is a hefty appetite for rumor. There's a hefty appetite for opinions about things that don't exist. One of my sports radio contributes to this. One of my pet peeves of late is what I call the presumptive conditional, which means that you say if such and such steroids, then you spend the rest of the column talking about as though the person did take steroids, even though it hasn't been proven.
Right.
And that is as much as anything contributes to this jaundiced view of the athletic culture that we now are experiencing and covering.
Well, what it, like, for instance, this week on the website, we had a columnist basically write that LeBron was having the greatest season, better than any Michael Jordan season. And the analysis for that was a statistical system that he had created that he was saying proved that LeBron statistically was having a better year. But there are a lot of components that he didn't mention, which, you know, like Jordan played a much tougher era. He played in an era where you were allowed to hand check guys. He played in an era where if you jumped to the basket, you were allowed to get clotheslined. LeBron's playing an era where he could do whatever he wants and he gets every call. And we ran that on the front page. And I'm reading that and thinking, that just feels sensationalistic to me. Like, it just seems like we're creating an angle out of nothing and not really trying to prove it. We're just throwing it out there. So how much of a, you know, how much culpability does ESPN have with this, with what's happening?
I hope not very much. I disagree with you on that particular column because I think that there is an argument to be made. And I think there were a lot of people in the Michael Jordan era who felt that he got every call.
He probably did.
That was a part of it. So that part is not different. It's the same.
No, but when he drove to the basket, though, he was getting knocked down.
Yeah, and LeBron's probably get knocked down a little bit less. And LeBron's only, you know, he's a little early on here, so give him a chance to get knocked down. That's probably going to happen a few times. I think
it'll be flagrant, though.
You have the changes in rules which affect the judgment. There's also, you know, because I believe that the comparison with Jordan, and there's the other comparison that I saw in SportsCenter, which I thought was terrific, about LeBron's year compared to Oscar Robertson's year of the triple doubles. And
because of the possessions and how different the possessions are back
and their statistical evidence. I mean, there's all kinds of, I find that kind of argument fun. I find it interesting. And I find your take, your give and take with, the writer of that column terrific. And I think that is a healthy, I mean, that was he put thought into it. He didn't put the same thinking into it that you put into it. So therefore that kind of clash of intelligent people putting down things and saying, okay, let's debate this out, whether it's Oscar Robertson. Isn't it fascinating you have Oscar Robertson, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, and you're throwing the three of them together and you're trying to compare all these eras? It's part of what the fun of sports is, and it's part of what the history of sports is that makes those kinds of things, you know, pretty darn interesting.
But I'm with you.
Ultimately, though, Bill, this is all going to be about the championships.
Yeah. Well, he argued the point statistically, and I argued the points when I tried to do them a little more big picture. So as I've told him, you don't watch Lost, but we're like the Jack and the Lock of Lost. But at the same time, Jordan was the greatest player ever. LeBron hasn't won a championship yet.
He is. To this point,
and
he is.
We're putting on our website, you know, asking if he's better than
well, you start, maybe
Jordan. He hasn't even won one title yet. Jordan won six.
It's premature. I agree with you. It's premature, but that's what sports is today, that these arguments come up. Now, I will say.
No, but go back to the ESPN part. So what is our role in this whole thing?
I'm going to put it another way. I've had conversations with Hubie Brown and Jack Ramsey. And I don't have respect for anybody more. I don't care who it is. And they happen to work for us. They didn't work for us all our life. Those two guys know more about basketball than anybody on earth.
Yeah.
And they know about it not just domestically. They know about it internationally. They know about it historically. They can give you stories from the 30s. They can give you whatever. And both of those people have said to me that they think LeBron has a shot to be better than Jordan.
I would agree that he has it, so to me
that begins, you know, when you're having a year like this, that's kind of, maybe it's premature, a little bit early, but it's beginning to plant now, which is why this May and June are going to be so great watching the NBA. It's going to be so terrific because you have all of these things and you have the ghost of Jordan kind of hanging around, and you have Kobe kind of, you know, where does he fit in with this?
Yeah.
And you have your Celtics, you know, trying to say, okay, can we do two in a row? What could be better? How great is this going to be?
And then Dwayne Wade kind of lingering as the guy who could potentially unseat anybody in one playoff series.
Man, he's a player. Wow.
The difference between Jordan and LeBron has nothing to do with stats or talent or any of that stuff. Jordan had a competitive instinct that only Bill Russell has had. And I just cannot accept.
Did Larry Bird have that?
Not to the degree.
Okay.
Not to the degree.
That's interesting.
I mean, I think he had a large piece of it, and so did Magic, and so did some others. This is, you know, a lot of what my book's about. But
well, Russell had it. Russell had it very, very early on. Jordan really didn't have it in those first early years.
I would argue he had it to the point that it was detrimental.
Yes.
He actually hurt his teammates. He was so competitive.
He was competitive mentally, but it was frustrating for him. It wasn't there. And I would argue that you're going to see, as LeBron goes on, and he's had a little bit of the taste when the San Antones, you know, beat him down.
And they're a redeemed team.
And now he's, I think you'll see a different LeBron here in May competitively.
But I hope, and actually if I had to bet on it, I would bet that you're right. But just, if we're going to start comparing people to Jordan, who is the greatest player ever, you have to have that homicidal killer instinct that Jordan had and Bill Russell had. Both of those guys, all they cared about was winning.
They didn't
care about anything else.
And boy, did they know how to do it. Russell, I mean, to me, Russell was, I mean, he was so much the best.
And now he never gets mentioned. Cause now it's like, oh yeah, he couldn't shoot. Meanwhile,
anybody,
the guy won 11 titles.
The point that, you know, you make about the tip balls and the rebounds compared to Dwight Howard and the way he did every little thing right. Everything. He was so good.
Let's talk about ESPN.
Okay. Talk about ESPN.
Explain to me why there's such a backlash against this company as a whole.
Well, I think for 25 years, and I sincerely mean this, for 25 years, ESPN was the beneficiary of the underdog mentality among people with critical opinions. And I think that the media, everybody wanted to succeed. What the heck? You know, there's a lot more jobs out there. ESPN established the notion that 24 hours of sports could work. They established the notion that we could build more around it, that there would be competitors, that there would be a Fox. There was a lot of people and a lot more jobs. So everybody was kind of rooting for ESPN. I think in year 25, people began to realize, because the people who ran ESPN and right before that had this vision that ESPN couldn't stand still and be one network. And people woke up and found out, wait a minute. They're not just ESPN, they're ESPN2, they're ESPN Classic, they're ESPN News, they're ESPN Magazine, they're ESPN.com, they're ESPN Radio, they're ESPN everywhere.
ESPN Gatorade.
I think that, and then there became a sort of jealousy, because there are a lot of people who would love to work at ESPN, but there was a limitation, believe it or not, although a couple of people from newspapers whom I love and admire say, you guys have an unlimited headcount, don't you? And I said, well, why don't you come to a couple meetings and get your head chopped off when you say something like that?
Right.
You know, but it's not, so that was one contributing factor. We celebrated our 25th anniversary. We did a lot of celebrating. I thought some really good programming. And all of a sudden we realized, and part of what television does, and the print media has a hard time understanding this, and it's one of the reasons that television has a leg up on print and is more successful, is part of the job that people feel is, and that you have to get the biggest possible audience to watch for the longest possible time. That's your job description.
Yep.
I don't think it's a job description of a newspaper editor that you have to get the largest number of readers reading for the longest time. The reading the most words, the most stories in the paper.
Yeah.
They don't think like that. So as a result, one of the tools that a network has is they have their own Barker channel, their own Barker time every hour, not Barker channel, Barker time every hour to say, hey, watch this, watch that. We think this will be good. I remember when Don Olmeyer was at NBC and he had Must See TV. And that was what NBC used to kind of hawk their primetime.
Yep.
And then, and we also had a very successful campaign called This is SportsCenter, which ran, which has run now almost 15, 16 years as a successful campaign. So we're able to kind of, promote what we thought people ought to stay, because you know what? Everybody's out there trying to get our business and eyeballs, and we'd like those eyeballs to stay with us because, you know, we're going to have a better business, and we think we're going to put on better programming.
I would say there are three factors. The 25th thing, which you mentioned, I think we went overboard. I think even you would admit that a little bit.
We are an overboard company.
Second, I think the phone, for whatever reason, it made people mad. It was like, I think the real issue here, and you know, I'd love to write a column about this, but I don't know if there's a way to write it for ESPN. I think, you know, it's
when you retire. Bill.
When I retire,
yeah.
But I think
chapter one.
I think the whatever level of hostility there is that's out there, and it's not that significant, but people kind of need ESPN to follow sports. You can't follow sports without it in a way, because you're going to have to watch SportsCenter. We have the rights to a lot of these games. ESPN.com, we have stories, you know, even if you don't want to read one of the columnists, we're still breaking information and we have stuff that people need. And it's almost like people are a little bit like, man, I can't get away from ESPN. And I think that's really what this is all about.
Well, thank you for telling everybody who works here that they're doing their jobs very well.
They are. In a roundabout way, that's what I said.
That's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
We're doing a very good job here.
If you're a sports fan, put it this way. If you're a sports fan, you could not turn off the ESPN switch for a year.
Because
we're just too infiltrated in the sports fan experience.
Well, let me say something about that. There is a culture here, which I came here and I was a creature from outer space that landed, you know, in the SportsCenter newsroom in 1988. And I didn't understand, you know, what I was doing here in terms of I had never done television, or did very little television. And then within 6 months, I figured, boy, this company is competitive. Everybody was looking at the networks on the weekends saying, how can I do it better? How could I do the graphics better? How could I put the cameras in better position? How could I do this news? So it played into, I'm a really competitive person. I loved it. I just love this atmosphere that let's be competitive. Let's do the best we possibly can. And tomorrow, let's be a little bit better than we were today. And that kind of culture and the culture of collaboration that is necessary when you have so many mediums and so many people producing content produces what inevitably is something that, you know, you're proud of. You're saying, yes, that's what our job is. We want people to feel they can't live without us because we're good. We don't want them to feel that they can't live without us because we promote too much. We have to deliver the goods. We have to deliver the black magic. We have to deliver the greatest game ever played. We have to deliver the streak. We have to deliver PTI. We have to deliver Bill Simmons. We have to deliver, we have to deliver that. We have to give them that kind of quality and we have to keep inventing it. We have to invent the homecoming show. We have to invent what's coming up, the Sports Nation show starting in July. And we can't, you can't stop. You have to be comfortable with failures. We've had a heck of a lot of failures here too. But the failures have made us better because we recognize it, we moved on, and we try to do something new again. It is the culture of our company that makes us that way.
I like that you got in a couple plugs. Why didn't you plug 30 for 30?
It's coming up. 30 for 30 is coming up. That's September. Yeah. So we got a while for that. I'm plugging Sports Nation because that's coming up in July.
Well, let me tell you a couple of my gripes with the company.
Come on, you don't have gripes.
A couple gripes. Yeah. I think we could have a better sense of humor about ourselves.
I would love that. That's why the one place we do accomplish that is in those SportsCenter ads. This is SportsCenter. I think that's one place. I wish we could transport that to a lot.
I mean the self-deprecating
yes.
type of sense
yes,
of humor.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
Well, why don't we have a more self-deprecating sense of humor?
Humor is a hard thing. Humor is a hard thing, and I'm not necessarily, I think sometimes you see it, but you don't see enough of it, and it's hard to find the opportunities for it. Kornheiser occasionally can do it pretty well, and sometimes it's just, you know, Tony sometimes is because he's just moaning over something, but he can be self-deprecating.
Yeah, he's kind of like my illegitimate dad, Kornheiser.
All right, so you're giving me my direction for the next year here. Self-deprecation. All right, that's number one.
No, I'm just saying a couple of my small gripes.
All right. I love that gripe.
You know, me personally, as a columnist, and you and I have battled about this. It's I just feel like we're infiltrated enough in the sports scene that, for instance, the Kornheiser, Tirico, Jaworski tandem, which I think everybody would agree is still a work in progress, correct?
Everything we do is a work in progress.
Okay. Maybe one of the top 10 stories of last year, football-wise, with football fans?
Not last year, maybe the first year.
You don't think last year, too? You don't think that was something that was discussed with NFL fans constantly?
I don't think – here's our mega disagreement is that fans – that a great number of fans discuss the media. I think a great number of fans – the discussion we just had about LeBron and Big O and – Bill Russell and statistics and all that. That's what sports fans love to discuss.
I agree on that.
This is such a small piece of the sports fans, you know, interests.
But on the other hand, I would have a very interesting angle on the whole Kornheiser experiment that for a variety of reasons, I probably couldn't write for our website because internally it would cause some problems.
We don't want to have people, you know, doing things critically within a company, going after one another. It's just not.
I'm not saying that. I wouldn't go after anybody.
You did a really good column on the 35th anniversary of Monday Night Football. Was that it?
Yeah.
That was a really good column on
that. Yeah, because I consulted with you about it.
No, but you did, but it was your idea and you wrote it. I gave you like three tips about, you know, what the coverage of cable versus over the air was, and maybe you ought to mention it. Those were,
right.
You know, minor. There were things. And, you know, I think thoughtful things like that can be done contextually.
Because for me, the Kornheiser, the root of the issue, and this is the same problem Dennis Miller faced, and I think, you know, if I was the third man in the booth, not that I had the chops to do it, but I would face the same thing, is that fundamentally people watching a football game want to hear from people who played football or coached it. And anybody outside that realm, they just don't trust their opinion on anything because they know that nobody knows, for whatever reason, football is the only sport that either the people who played it and coached it have a whole other level of perspective versus anybody who didn't play it or coach it. And so, I think that's the fundamental problem is that.
So why was Howard Cosell so popular and such a galvanizing point?
Well, he was a popular and unpopular.
Yes.
I mean, there were the polls where he was the most popular and the least popular.
Yes, that's correct. But you can't argue that he wasn't very, very successful.
You're talking about one of my favorite media people ever. Yeah. The difference with Cosell, I think, is that it was a different era.
Well, that's a cop out.
No, I'm just saying
it was
the 70s. Like some weird stuff happened.
The difference
back
between
then.
LeBron and Michael Jordan is it's a different era.
I'm saying
the different era cop out. Come on.
No. I'm saying I don't think Cosell works today.
Oh, I think he works marvelously today.
I think the
extremes to which he might go might be a little out there, but he'd work great today.
I don't think so.
Come on, who started talk radio? Speaking of spots, come on.
But I think that's where his destiny would be. I think he'd have some sort of a radio show, and he'd be the host of the sports reporters, and he'd probably be the host of Real Sports. I don't see people accepting him on a baseball game. And even if you watch on ESPN Classic, like he stepped over his play-by-play guys. Like he was actually a lot less competent than I think we remember. I think we romanticized him a little bit.
Well, you know, there's a certain degree of romance to incompetence or the lack of competence. You know, one of the things I was going through, looking through a blooper reel this week of, and we can't put together blooper reels because we're so darn good anymore. But those blooper reels from the 80s and the early 90s, they're fantastic.
Right. Well, I think with Kornheiser, like, I feel bad for him because I just think for football, it's I don't want to say it's a no-win, but the odds are really stacked against you. Whereas if we had him in basketball and he was doing games with Breen and Van Gundy and he was the third guy and he knows enough about basketball and basketball is an easy enough sport that you can really follow it and know what you're talking about even if you didn't play or coach and he was pumping Van Gundy for stuff, I just feel like that would be a better fit. For not just for him, but for anybody who's trying to do that third man in the booth thing.
Well, you know, you have your. I think that in all of sports broadcasting, and this is not about ESPN for me, in all of sports broadcasting, we have to be able to say how do we take the level of the broadcast and take it to the more contemporary era, Are we still doing games the way we did games and broadcasting them as broadcasters the way they did it in the 1970s, the 1980s? You have to find and look for new and different ways to distinguish yourself and also to kind of entertain fans who are, you know, you want to get as many fans as you want watching the games.
Right.
And I think you can do that through a variety of people. And I'm not saying that the formula that we have is the best possible formula, but I do think you have to keep trying new and different formulas, new and different combinations that, you know, hopefully someday are going to click and say, yeah, okay, that's comfortable.
My third thing.
Okay.
I don't know why we run away from sexuality in sports. We're just terrified of it. Like, for instance, Erin Andrews has had a ton of success for us, I think, and she's, would you argue, one of the more popular talents that we have?
Oh, she's popular.
And I think the first reason is because she's very good at her job, and the second reason is she's pretty and guys like her. The second reason is not nearly as important as the first reason, but it's a reason. So, what is the big deal about having a sideline reporter where looks factor into it?
By far the most important I think are leaders in hiring women in sports.
I agree.
I don't think there's percentage wise on air, wherever we are, we try to hire women. We even have women do play by play. We have women do everything. We don't hire them. Listen, it's a visual medium. If somebody happens to be, in the mind's eye of somebody better looking than somebody else with men or women, that's not the factor. The factor is, hey, how much do you know about sports? How good are you at doing your job, whether it's asking questions? How insightful are you? And how well can you report or how well can you write a show? And those are the only factors that you should have, whether you're a man or a woman. And I believe in that and always will.
But would you agree that sexuality has creeped into our society in the last 10 years and our society is different than it was?
It's crept into our society since Adam met Eve. That's my answer to that. I don't think it's any different today than it was then.
What do you think about, like, let's say Erin Andrews is wearing a halter top in a baseball game, or whatever happened last year that turned out to be a stupid thing in the blogosphere?
You know, like, people have opinions on dress, and you know, it's very hard. You know, what about a male sideline reporter that has a shirt open down to his navel?
I would love that. With chains? Can I get chains?
Come on.
This
is going into a segment that's going to get killed. Like it's
No. It's 2009. Women are women. They dress and carry themselves with a lot more confidence and sexuality than they did, and that should be represented on TV.
But there is a point at which something, whether it's a man or a woman, there is a point at which it's inappropriate for television. If you're drawing more attention to the way you dress than you are to what you're doing, your job, then you got to really maybe think about it, who you are.
But what's the job? I mean,
the job
seriously.
Is to be really good at whatever the job description is. And I can send you, I don't know if I ever send you, we have a 50 page manual on sideline reporting.
Do you ever see it? Listen, one of my buddies, Rob Stone, has been doing it for 10 years. I think there's good ways to do it and bad ways to do it.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I think you sent it to me a couple years ago.
And you've read it carefully, I know.
I haven't read it carefully, I don't think. But I don't know. I don't understand why we're so uptight about this stuff. Even, you know, this thing that happened with Barack Obama last week where he didn't fill out the women's bracket and that turned into this huge controversy.
There's a level of appropriateness. That's a whole other issue about the promotion of women's sports. And, you know, and I put in my commercial for the local team here, even though can't be a local cheerleader here. But the fact is that right now in women's sports, we have the best season to this date that a team has ever had in any sport.
You're talking about UConn.
UConn women. Spectacular. But the point here is that at some point something is inappropriate and it's arbitrary and you may see it differently from the way John Skipper, who is my boss, sees it, mm-hmm. who may see it differently from somewhere else. And you have to reach some kind of a consensus as who's ever calling the shots, that's good, that's not good. And it has to deal with not just with dress, it has to deal with language, it has to deal with topic, it has to deal with a whole number of things in our discussing a media.
Well, maybe we could use one of our smaller leagues as some sort of test case for.
I don't know how you know how that's tested. That's tested by the people who are in charge making a judgment and saying that's appropriate for us. That's kind of their job. And as one of our best employees here, Don Squire, says, that's why they call it work.
Right. All right. Fourth thing.
How many are there?
I think this might be the last one. Right. I mean, I could expand the list to 40, but I was going to settle on four.
Yeah. Your audience is getting a little tired now.
No, they love this. They're on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, I bet they are.
There's bloggers like transcribing this right now. The fourth thing is the whole sponsorship. And, you know, like the ESPN magazine this week is an example. Talk about SportsCenter. We have all these bits in there where it's like, basically I watch SportsCenter. It's like, all right, we made money there. We made money there. We made money there. And to be honest, I miss the old SportsCenter. I just feel like we make enough money as a company that we don't need all the, you know, to just kind of bleed SportsCenter with all these different
singers. It's not our job to, you know, criticize how much or how little money we make. It's other people who have to, you know, determine that.
Fair point.
But I do think that there is an ongoing issue in the meaning. It's in every medium. It's, you know, when do you put an ad on the front page of a newspaper? And how much does that interfere with what you're doing? When I worked in the internet with you, 8 or 9 years ago, I remember, you know, there were ads, we had like flying eagles underneath, the copy of a news story. And I say, my God, what is this? And I think that, you know, the marketplace tests itself out. You do what you can. We are a business, and we have, you know, a part of our business is commercials. There are taste issues with commercials. There are placement issues with commercial, you know, ad placement. And I remember, you know, one day when the president who hired me here at ESPN is talking about commercials at one point, and you know, and I said to him, I said, will you agree that we're going to go overboard when there's a commercial on Chris Berman's forehead? You know, I mean, it's these things you constantly have to be, and the advertisers are pushing it with all different mediums. And the mediums that are not as so successful are going to make more allowances for more insertion into editorial content. The advertiser wants bonuses. The advertiser doesn't want to advertise now unless the advertiser is somehow more closely associated with the content, which it makes this very difficult. We have undergone, since I've been here, Bill, you know, three or four different policies, which we've drawn up every 3 or 4 years to say, where are we drawing the line? What are we doing here? We constantly look at it. We constantly look at the competition. And we even have people who have job descriptions who are responsible for the give and take back and forth with people who produce content and the people who are selling advertising about how can we make something work that's not going to infringe upon the editorial autonomy or independence of what we're trying to produce. So, I mean, I'm kind of just giving you the background of what it is, and it's every individual situation. Believe me, there are debates that are had. There are back and forths that go on. There's postmortems that go on after, you know, things happen. And, you know, you and I are on the side of, you know, we grew up with a lot less of editorial advertisement insertion into editorial, but it is coming out, and you see it in different ways. I mean, whoever thought that the fronts of the New York Times sections would have ads? How many years did they go with that and decide not? You don't want to be caught where the newspaper business is today because they didn't do it early enough.
John Walsh, brought to you by the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. John, that was a good segue.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. We're an entertainment company, we're a news organization, and we're a business enterprise. And we're all three of those things at the same time. And if you look at how much money ESPN makes as a company, obviously doing it very successfully. But at what point does the sponsors and, you know, trying to get those sponsors and trying to rake as much money as you can, at what point does that start to hurt you as a news entity?
That's what you keep, you keep measuring it and saying, you know what, I can live with that, I can't live with that, and that goes on every day. That's part of the discussion. Just as, you know, who would have ever thought, let's invent a 24-hour sports network that buys rights from leagues and teams and then does news coverage half the day that covers those leagues and teams critically and has a lot of commentators who give opinions that the teams and the leagues and the players are not going to like. What a terrible business that would be. That just sounds like an awful prescript for inventing a business.
The fifth thing that worries me, fifth and final.
Until the sixth comes up.
Well, until I think of a sixth. No, this is the fifth and final.
Okay,
and
all right. We're really going to wrap this up sometime, huh?
We're going to wrap this up. This is it.
They're locking up the buildings here, you know.
Get Joe Mead some water and some oxygen. I do worry that, I mean, have you noticed that kind of secretly, quietly, we've gotten the rights to almost every sport?
Well, you know, there was a time at which in a while back where we had the four major sports and we sent Kenny Mayne when we had them all active in one day on draft day and across the country to go to all the sports. We've had this for a while, and you know
to this degree though.
No,
now you have college football, and
yeah,
now
we
you
do, but we have
basketball.
We have a lot less golf. We don't have the NHL. You know, we have a lot, but that's who we are. That's the company that we are. I like where we are. I'd like to have, you know, the baseball playoffs. I'd like to have football playoffs and the NFL. But, you know, these are reasons that you and I are doing this and we're not out negotiating. There are people who get paid from the leagues and there are people who get paid for ESPN for that's their jobs. And we're always happy to be the beneficiaries of it. And it's terrific that we do. And I'm glad we work where we do because we do have that.
Do you worry though about, you know, your business partners with these guys and you're also covering them objectively and you have people writing and talking about them provocatively in the website and the magazine, the radio. And sometimes that clashes. We saw it recently.
No, it definitely clashes in places. And I think we spend a lot of time, in the last couple of years, I'm the chairman of an editorial board that meets about once a month, and
I was going to bring that up.
Our sixth year now with the editorial board, and we try and discuss these policies. We're a very self-critical company that kind of looks at these arrangements. One thing that I'm really proud of here is that we hired an ombudsman, and the last ombudsman got more critical praise than any other critic. So we actually hired our best critic according to our fans.
You hired a critically acclaimed critic.
Yes. How about that? You don't
right.
get that every day. Anyway, yes, we look at these issues on an ongoing basis, and we try and get the best possible guidance and direction we can so that we're able to do our jobs in a way that's fair and that allows for people to be critical but that does not allow them to be personal, that, you know, and we did some, you know, we do some fairly critical stories. That Penn State football story that we did in the summer. Wow, that was a tough story. And look how Penn State came back. And, you know, they understood. They understood where it is. And sometimes I think, Bill, in some of these stories that are investigative and critical, I think it's there's a certain amount somewhere deep inside the people whom we cover who run these things say, well, it's not a bad idea for us to be aware of this and to pay attention to it, just as it's not a bad idea for ESPN to have a self-awareness of the things that we're not doing so well and we maybe should improve upon. I believe that that's very helpful, and it helps all of us be better at what we do.
Have you hired a new ombudsman yet?
No, we haven't. No,
Do I send a resume in?
Oh, yes, yeah. We'll have. No, you can send your resumes of all your podcast buddies in. You know. Actually, Klosterman would be a good one.
Why couldn't I be the ESPN ombudsman?
Oh, you could. You take a cut in salary.
Why couldn't I do it on top of my column?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
That would be fun. Maybe I'll just write them on my own time and hand them into myself.
Yeah, and then you can publish them someday.
Look, you've been at ESPN now 21 years.
Yes, I have.
So what do you think has been the single biggest thing that has changed about the company from 1988 to 2009?
The biggest thing by far is the expansion from a single network to a multimedia, multi-platform, multi 24-hour network company.
With a campus.
With what is now referred to as a campus. I know some cynical friends of mine said, please don't tell me you call it a campus.
Well, what else are you going to call it? A compound? Like, it makes it sound like it's like David Koresh, the ESPN compound. Yeah, I think campus is the right word.
Maybe we should have a contest. Campus is the right word for ESPNU.
I like ESPN campus. Okay. I think that's good.
Okay.
So what do you think the next 5 years hold? Give me two predictions and I'll let you go.
Two predictions in the next 5 years. In what area?
For ESPN as a company.
ESPN.
Two things that you think will happen for us as a company that maybe people aren't totally seeing yet from the outside world. Unless that's giving away business secrets, which you don't have.
Well, I think we continually look around to see what makes sense in our company and what's happening, whether it's international, which it took us a long time to figure out what the international paradigm is for our business, and now we've been very successful with it. I think we're going to get more diverse in our coverage of topics and areas of concentration because the world of sports is becoming more diverse in its issues. Mm-hmm. That are popping up. I think we're going to be trying new and different. We have three or four new shows that we're in development with, and Sports Nation is the first one that's going to launch on July the 6th.
Yeah.
And I hope that, you know, we continually look at the development of ESPNU is a large thing on our agenda, that we want to make ESPNU vital to every college student every day of the week to come in and watch it, and that's a big mandate for us.
That would have been one of my two choices
in the next year. What's your second choice?
No, I think ESPNU is going to really evolve. It's an idea that makes a lot of sense to me, and there's a huge void for it. And I could even see like an ESPNU.com, and there's a niche there. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I agree.
What I mean?
And it's kind of like I spent a couple of years at Rolling Stone magazine in the 70s, and Rolling Stone had to make
How did I not mention that?
I don't know. The Rolling Stone had to make a decision at one point as to whether they wanted to get old with their audience or they wanted to stay young and turn over their audience and remain young. And it was a really easy business decision, which is the same thing for ESPNU. When we're looking at our target audience, we're looking at the college student who is a sports fan.
Right.
And that's the target audience. We're not going anywhere else. We're not looking at the alumni. We're not looking at any other aspect of it.
What did you decide at Rolling Stone?
The Rolling Stone decided that we'd stay young and we would put, you know, Gossip Girls on the cover or whatever the culture called for that was the youth culture.
Right. Okay. You're going to have to come back next time to talk about Rolling Stone because that's like its own podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I watched the Hunter documentary last night, not the good one, the other one, but, you worked pretty closely with him, and you were instrumental in bringing him to ESPN, all that stuff.
Yeah, well, we'll bore people to death over that one. You know, we haven't put him to sleep enough now. Please.
Oh, please. The Hunter thing will be great. And you know, honestly, I was thinking our decade's coming to an end here. Is it 2009?
It's going to come to an end while we're on this podcast, I think.
Well, we're ending it right now.
Okay.
2009 is the end of this decade, which will be called the aughts or the double zeros.
I'm an aughts guy.
Yeah, I like the aughts. And I think my biggest single regret of the entire decade was not going with you to see Hunter, not realizing that he was going to die. But we had a weekend, and it didn't work out. And I can't even remember what the reason was.
That was something that you should have experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't get over that yeah, I missed that.
I can't either. There are two or three people. But, you know, Hunter used to say when I'd say, he would finally grant me exceptions, but I'd say, Hunter, I want to introduce you to somebody. Can't do it. Why is that, Hunter? Somebody else has to die first.
He had a waiting list for his life?
Yeah. It was waiting list to, you know, to get introduced to somebody.
Well, they said that he would just call people in the middle of the night, and it was, and like they talked about the documentary, like everybody knew if the phone rang.
That was Hunter.
Either it was Hunter or something terrible had happened with somebody.
You were praying it was Hunter. You were always praying it was Hunter.
Always hoped it was Hunter.
And it was always Hunter. I mean, that was it. You knew if you were on that list, that was a good list to be on.
Well, maybe.
That was a great list to be on.
He died in February 2005, so maybe the five-year anniversary, we'll have a 100 podcast.
That'll be fine.
All right.
I'm
thank
up for
you.
That. All right.
Thank you for all your time, and thank you for all your candidness.
Goodbye.
Your candor.
Okay. We'll cut that candor out. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Target to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
And that concludes another episode of the BS Report. And here's 55 more words that Bill Simmons intended to mention, but unfortunately ran out of time. Now you can get any regular piled high Subway footlong for just $5. The keyword is any. The sweet onion chicken teriyaki, savory chicken and bacon ranch, the meaty taste bud pleasing Italian BMT. All the regular famous Subway footlongs, just $5. Subway, eat fresh. See store for details.